So this is, I should say, this is joint work being done with a large team of our colleagues from the National Drug Abuse Treatment Systems Survey, which many of you may have seen over the years. I should say that I am not important enough to have any disclosures, although we do thank NIDA for funding on an R1. So the Affordable Care Act is the largest and most ambitious expansion of coverage for mental health and substance abuse services in recent history. And I don't think the general public quite realizes how big ACA actually is expanding coverage through the marketplaces and through Medicaid, through including behavioral health services within the essential health benefit package. So these services have to be covered and at parity, linkages to primary care, and also coverage of new kinds of preventive services such as ESPRT. And one of the striking things, I was one of the aunts who helped carry ACA up the hill, and one of the things that really struck me was how many of the people who were the most vociferous opponents of ACA in the Congress, Republicans who voted against the bill and spoke out against it, voted for these substance use provisions in committee. And there was not a divisive politics around substance abuse in a way that one might have predicted based on past experience. So ACA is tremendous and it's ambitious. And why is it so important? I'll just show you just quickly some data about the folks that prior to health reform were left out. So this is just data that I pulled from the 2013 NISDA and looked at individuals who were both uninsured and who satisfied the NISDA criteria for some sort of a substance use disorder. And I should say that many of these people, if they may have been getting substance use treatment services, although mostly not, if they were within a system that was very much disconnected from the standard system of medical care and healthcare finance. And also these patients, in part because they were in this siloed system, enjoyed very little choice or options about the kinds of care that they could get if they wanted to get their care within a more integrated system or a less stigmatized system than the specialty addiction system typically is. So just here's just the 4.8 million Americans who show up in the 2013 NISDA who are both uninsured and have a substance use disorder. It's basically young men, mostly white, 80% of whom have alcohol disorders, and who prior to health reform were basically shut out of much of what our health system has to offer. When ACA fully kicks in, you know, when the Messiah comes and all the states have taken up the Medicaid expansion, I'm not getting anywhere with any of my humor here. I guess references to the Messiah, given our society's religious literacy, are starting to become less funny. But in the end, 62 million Americans are projected to get coverage for mental health and substance use services once ACA is fully implemented. And in one way, this is amazing, and I think it's something to celebrate, but wow, it's also a daunting challenge as well. So the challenge to the Specialty Addiction Center from ACA is tremendous, and if you talk to people in the sector, people are quite scared of it in many ways. So first of all, welcome. Many addiction providers will have to contract with FQHCs, patient-centered medical homes, various kinds of integrated care arrangements that they're not used to participating in and that may or may not want to play with them. Also, the modal patient who now is uninsured will be a Medicaid patient. And that's just a profound change. Now, who is it that the Medicaid expansion population is really serving? It's serving basically a person of low income who's not a mom, who's not a vet, who doesn't satisfy criteria for federal disability programs. That's your typical substance abuse treatment client that we're describing. And now the addiction sector is going to have to compete with other Medicaid providers that these patients are already dealing with and maybe more comfortable with. Also, providers will have to figure out how to actually interface with Medicaid and that means satisfying Medicaid's regulatory requirements. You may need a physician on staff to either provide treatment or approve a treatment plan. It also means you have to be able to bill Medicaid, and just basic things like, do I have an HIT system that actually works with Medicaid? These are tremendous burdens that many treatment providers are mom and pop operations compared to most of the healthcare delivery system. They've got a huge challenge. So the framers of ACA anticipated this challenge and provided some supports for states to help address that. So there were some technical supports available to states, some funds that they could use, some ability to reallocate substance abuse prevention and treatment block grant funds that are now basically being used as personal health services. Some of those could be reallocated to help with this transition. There are resources potentially available, but very little is known about what states are actually doing to prepare for this challenge. Okay. So we've been doing the National Drug Abuse Treatment System Survey for 25 years now, and we've been doing nationally representative surveys for most of the life of this outpatient substance abuse treatment facilities. Now, what we did in the last wave was we included surveys of single state agencies, insurance commissions, and Medicaid to examine some of the ACA Medicaid issues. And we're just getting started, but in fact, this is one of the first papers that's come out of it. But we're trying to understand what's happening at the state level, and then does it percolate through to the individual behavior of treatment providers. We did find in the single state agencies that we got a 98% response rate. We got one state that didn't. I was going to call back that one state, and I was going to threaten them that we were going to title our paper "What's Happening in All of America Except for Blank," but that cooler heads prevailed. We asked respondents a variety of questions about what they were doing to help addiction treatment centers in their state. Are they helping create IT systems, electronic records infrastructure, obtaining Medicaid certification, becoming an approved provider to deal with private insurance plans? These are all very difficult processes, collaborating with FQHCs, mental health providers, or the criminal justice system. One of the interesting things in a place like Illinois is the criminal justice system is a big, big source of the Medicaid expansion population. And a lot of these folks obviously have some kind of behavioral health issue. How are these organizations going to deal with that? Also, education and training to meet the rising demand that we predict, based on what we've seen in some of the early states, we're going to see in the addiction sector. And we also want to see whether states were actually putting money other than what the federal government was providing. Were they giving their own money to help accomplish any of these tasks? Okay. We analyzed the data. We did t-tests on our data. Nothing too interesting there. And what we found was a pretty simple story, which was states aren't doing very much. States provide very little support relative to the need. About half the states were using federal dollars to provide technical support for IT or electronic health records. Less than a third were helping units interact with private insurers or to assist with enrollment and outreach. One of the big challenges we have in Medicaid is a lot of the patients that have addiction issues who are eligible for the Medicaid expansion, you're going to have to go out and get those people. They're not going to just show up. And particularly at this point, when the people who would show up have already shown up, there's a big need for outreach and enrollment. And we also found that very few states are using their own money to do pretty much anything in ACA. So only three states allocated any of their own money to assist providers with implementation. So if we look across the categories, we see that about half are providing some technical assistance with IT and EHR. And you can see obtaining Medicaid certification and collaborating with FQHCs, a lot of them are doing that. Many fewer are helping people interface with the private insurance system or in other ways improve quality and implementation. What's striking, though, is if you stratify by Medicaid expansion versus non-expansion. And we really see some differences there. Well, I'm going to slice the data two different ways just to show you what's happening. It's a very simple descriptive paper. If we look at things like technical assistance with IT, there's not too much of a difference between Medicaid expansion and not. But there are some areas that really are sensitive to Medicaid. So what we see is when you look at, are you providing technical assistance and support for outreach? The Medicaid expansion states are doing it, at least to some degree. 40% of the states are doing that. The non-expansion states, basically about a third of, are doing it at about a third of that level. And of course, it makes a lot of sense. If you're not going to cover people, then doing outreach becomes a lot less interesting to state policymakers. And so, they're just not active in that area at all. We do see, for example, a lot of them are trying to work on criminal justice and mental health, that interface. There's a lot of good stuff happening, but there's a big but in terms of outreach and really getting people who are uninsured, it's the Medicaid states that are doing the heavy lifting. We also looked at the difference between state exchanges and the federal exchange. And now, there's a big overlap between the states that expanded Medicaid and the ones that have their state exchanges, but we did see some differences that we could tease out a little bit in the data. And the state exchanges were just doing a lot more to try to do technical support because they just had a bigger stake. And if you look at all the bars to the right here, you see that state exchanges at least were willing to do something to help with implementation, and the states that relied on the federal exchange were providing very little for EHR and other matters, and so there's clearly an ownership that's involved in being a state exchange that just isn't there if you're relying on the federal exchange. We can't fully tease this out from the Medicaid issue, but they're both important. Some other noteworthy patterns. We did see that the Medicaid expansion states shifted somewhat how they were using their block grants. One interesting pattern was they were using more of the block grant to cover long-term residential treatment than the other states were. And we think that what's going on is they're trying to fill the gaps for services that Medicaid won't pay for. You know, one of the challenges we have is now that the modal patient is becoming a Medicaid patient, it's always been the case that Medicaid has been very reluctant to cover long-term residential services within large institutional settings. And if a state's providing that, it's more problematic now that there's an effort to Medicaid optimize for all of their substance abuse treatment services. We also found that there's a little bit more money spent on prevention, although not much. There's so much demand for block grant dollars that the prevention efforts are often the things that get squeezed out. We also saw that in the expansion states, the Medicaid expansion states, that the units were much more likely to be involved in Medicaid health homes and other integrated care arrangements than we could see in the other states. And so 51% of the patients that were involved in our surveys, at units that were surveyed by our survey, 51% of them were at least in units that were connected to a Medicaid health home. In the non-expansion states, the comparable number was 6%. So the integrated care arrangements seem to be vastly different between expansion and non-expansion states. There are seats in the front, by the way, if you want to come and sit down. So just to wrap up, ACA has tremendous potential to improve access to substance abuse treatment. Tremendous implementation challenges that come with that. We can expect the federal government and private foundations to basically do all the heavy lifting right now based on what we're seeing. Just not a lot of state dollars being used for the nuts and bolts implementation issues that need to be confronted. From the provider side, as they face this tremendous challenge, one of the most obvious patterns that we see is that the small providers are the ones that are the most likely to be squeezed out in this process. They're the most dependent on technical assistance, which often isn't there. They're the least attractive to the integrated care entities that under ACA are becoming more and more important. Now, if you say, is this a good thing or a bad thing, the answer is yes. I think it's a good thing that a lot of these providers basically don't provide particularly proficient care, and they're now... their patients now have a choice to go elsewhere, and they will. And if 20% of the sector doesn't disappear, ACA's probably done something wrong. On the other hand, a lot of these small providers that are struggling provide a lot of unique value. and there's a lot of cultural competence. They have a public health mission, and something of value might well be lost if we just allow the trajectory that we seem to be on to take its course. So ACA has certainly been a terrific thing in many ways, but it's also raising some concerning issues, and that's what we're going to be working on looking forward. And thank you very much.